welcome back to It's an Inside Job podcast. I'm your host, Jason Lim. Now, this podcast is dedicated to helping you to help yourself and others to become more mentally and emotionally resilient so you can be better at bouncing back from life's inevitable setbacks. Now, on It's an Inside Job, we decode the science and stories of resilience into practical advice, skills, and strategies that you can use to impact your life and those around you. Now, with that said, let's slip into the stream. Well, welcome back. Thanks for joining me for another week on It's an Inside Job. This week is a special episode. It's a confluence of two of my series. One where I talk to HR professionals as to how they build individual and organizational resilience, but also talking to Ukrainians about understanding how they are dealing with the ongoing invasion, the ongoing conflagration that is happening on the borders of Europe. So I'm very happy and privileged to be joined by Svetlana Belushkina. Svetlana is an international business-driven HR professional with a proven track record in strategic HR, talent management, people, and organizational development. She has more than 20 years of experience in leading global and local HR functions, developing and executing programs aimed to build up critical capabilities of the organization, ensuring there's the right talent and at the right place and time to deliver on the business objectives. Currently, she works for Zalando, but she's also worked for giant corporations such as Deutsche Telekom and Telenor in Norway. And so in this week's episode, we breach both subjects about HR resilience and organizational resilience, and also understanding how the ongoing conflict in Ukraine is affecting people and how we can bring these two and merge these two ideas together when we talk about resilience. So let's slip into the stream and meet Svetlana Belushkina. Well, Svetlana, welcome to It's an Inside Job. I really appreciate you could be with me today. I was wondering, perhaps for our audience, if you could introduce who you are and what you're about and what you do.
Yes, with pleasure. So I am Svetlana. If you describe my journey and kind of try to understand me, I was raised in Ukraine, and I always had an opportunity and a desire to really make an impact and change the world for the better. And I was, you know, through my journey trying to find my places where I could really do that. So I started my journey working in the civil society of Ukraine and trying to support Ukraine to build up becoming more democratic country. I ended up being in the NGO, non-governmental organizations, and supporting them to become sustainable and to build up organizations that last and make an impact. And then my journey went into telecommunications, where I also was building up HR functions and dealing with people and organizations. And from there, I stayed there. So I have more than 20 years of HR professional experience in Ukraine and in many countries. So I've worked in Scandinavia, I worked in Asia, I worked in Eastern Europe. I lived in 5 countries, but mainly doing HR.
And I think this episode is a confluence of two series that I'm running. First is talking to HR professionals such as you with deep experience and knowledge, and to share how to create more resilient organizations and individuals. But it's also talking to you as a Ukrainian to understand what it is that's going through your head and how your countrymen and yourself build resilience. So it's this confluence is a very interesting episode. I look forward to exploring your ideas and your knowledge and experience. Just to begin with, I'm curious, you know, we're well out of the pandemic and hopefully we stay out of it. I was wondering from an HR perspective, how important was this function during the pandemic with lockdowns and isolation and such? From your perspective?
I believe it was really fundamental, Jason, because this is the time when HR was at the front end. HR was in the fields, right? Because we had to make sure our people are safe, our people can work, they have an opportunity and access to tools. They can connect with each other. They can be safe if they have to be in the fields as well. So I remember working 24/7. I remember my colleagues sleeping in the offices, trying to make sure it is safe, it's cleaned. You know, we really changed it and it's applicable to come back to work. So I believe HR as a profession also, my colleagues have been on the front line, and it has been exhausting times for them. Then after it all, in a way, was cleaned up, where we found the new ways of working, we found ways for the call center to function, for the people to actually perform the work, then you have to look into other elements, right? So what it means to lead virtually? What is the hybrid afterwards? You know, how does it function? How do you create connections? Does the remote ways of working are effective or not? In what do you believe? So in all of it, HR has to be involved. So I believe these 2 years of pandemic changed HR a lot and evolved HR a lot. New topics, you know, have been rising right now. Mental health, resilience, which you're talking about. I don't remember myself talking about mental health or resilience as much as we are doing now, right? So I think it also made HR a bit more human again, in a way, right? It was supposed always to be very much human and very much for people and organizations. But those 2 years of, you know, COVID and pandemics really elevated that.
I think what you said, you know, the focus on well-being and resilience and tenacity and fortitude and being almost the frontline workers to make sure everything's in place so the business can move forward, even in the crazy times, the surreal times that we've just moved through. And so when you talk about, you said, you know, you and your colleagues, you saw them working 24/7. Some of them were sleeping at the office, exhausted. I mean, how did it affect you personally? I mean, how did you find a sense of resilience in the chaos? Because there was so much uncertainty, so much that we didn't know about this virus and what it meant. Now we know a lot, but and we can say things with hindsight. But when you place yourself, you and your colleagues, back in the moment when the chaos hit, what was your initial reactions as a department, as a team?
Of course, we had to be connected and we had to respond much faster. And it was more of a crisis management, Jason. Mm-hmm. And at that point in time, I was not thinking about resilience. You just had to do the job you had to do and wake up and do it again. So it was more really streamlining your work, connecting with people, deliver what needs to be delivered. So I never saw such a unification of my colleagues together, right, in a company. It was fantastic times at the same time. It was super tough, but also fantastic team spirit that I saw among my colleagues. I think the realization came much later, you know, when things became a bit more, if you can say, normal again, and then when you start feeling this exhaustion, right, and you realize that you have to go forwards again and you have to support organizations even more with things like leadership and culture and remote ways of working. And that's where, you know, you just became very tired. And I think those days, that's when I started thinking about resilience for my teams and for myself a bit more structurally. Before, I wasn't even, you know, I wasn't even thinking about that. And I have to confess, Jason, so when you asked me to do the podcast, yes. Yeah, it's actually one of the first times when I thought about resilience as organizational muscle. Because you can train that and you can train yourself, right? But I didn't spend enough time on that consciously. And I also think many of my colleagues and friends in the HR profession haven't done it either. So I think this is just still evolving. It's there. Some organizations do it better than others, but it's still evolving. And I'm very grateful for an opportunity to reflect myself and to share actually what I think about resilience.
And so, you know, resilience, we all understand what it is. But as you said, organizations and individuals may operationally define it slightly different. I'm curious to know, Svitlana, how do you operationally define resilience? What is resilience in your mind?
In a way, if you look into, again, as I mentioned, Jason, I wanna talk about resilience from the HR perspective, for my colleagues in HR, and also for my teams that I'm leading. Sure. So if you look into HR, and I don't really like HR statements, HR phrase, because HR is a human resources. I like to describe this function as people and organization. So you work with people and you work with the organization. And I want to define resilience from the lens of the organization and lens of. And resilience, let's define resilience. Yeah, it's your ability to bounce back from crisis or difficulties. You know, how quickly do you stand up on your feet and you move forward? So if you look into the organization per se, there has been, organizations experienced many crises, many difficult black swans. COVID is one of them. We had a crisis in 2007. The war in Ukraine for many Ukrainian businesses, but now also in the European businesses, is a big black swan. And how do you react to that part? When I was researching what resilience means for organizations, the model which I really liked, and I want to shout out, it's to this person and his academy, is Josh Berzin. And I really liked how he defines. So in a way, I'm going to share, it's not my Svetlana's model, it's actually Berzin's model, but you will have some of my flavor on top of it. But that's really resonated with me. So it has organizational parts of resilience. It has five elements, according to George Berzin, and I can also try to connect it from my experience. Number one is the distributed operational model with central coordination. So it's how you organized. And this is what I also see right now in the Ukrainian businesses, right? So the model where you say, you have a central team and you centrally say, here, you do that, go ahead and do it, doesn't work anymore, right? So you really have to decentralize the power, and you have to empower people in the fields and to make sure they run and they perform their work with the central coordination. And that's what happened in the Ukrainian businesses, when 24th of February hits, or as a preparation, or even after. You saw that, there has been big movements of self-steering, self-organizations, agile management, where you would have people in the field connected with central teams and kind of getting all this power inside the companies to support the people, to support the families. The same in HR. So you have, in HR, you have a business partnership. Those people are embedded in the business and they are in the fields. So those people know what is happening and what the business needs, and able to translate business requirements into what we do day to day in HR. And you have central teams, have some central coordination, you have central people operations, you have central potential talent acquisition, and how those elements work together and how they connect is incredibly important for resilience. Now, I saw organizations where it worked and I saw organizations just didn't.
Yeah, I think I've talked to some military people, and I think their thinking is right along the lines as yours, especially when it comes to decentralized, because it's about placing the trust, the accountability, and responsibility with people that are sort of local, depending on what local is defined as. And it's for them to have situational awareness, because sometimes communication lines get cut off or something happens, and those teams that are localized at a certain area, they have to sometimes have to make calls. So it's giving them a sense of responsibility and a level of accountability where they can make calls, where sometimes if they can't have that communication with the central hub, they can still move forward. There's that trust and that transparency. And to build this decentralized model, I think is quite fascinating, because that means before a crisis happens, before some situation happens, you've already had to establish the level of psychological trust, emotional intelligence, a learning culture, a feedback culture, where you can have this.
Exactly. And again, going back to HR, Jason, into the business partnership, you described it beautifully, right? When you're in the field, when you are a business partner, let's say, whether it's for marketing or technology or customer care organization, you have to be connected to people. You have to be connected to the leadership teams. You have to be connected to the business objectives. You feel like in the sense of your fingertips, what is happening in there and how you support. And then, of course, it has to be central coordination where you give this information to the central teams to work together. But that connection and empowerment is super crucial for resilience. So that would be my number one out of five organization, which I would really underline for the
resilience. What would be your second then?
My second one would be is a capability per se in HR organizations.
The capabilities, yeah?
Yeah, HR has to be trained, cross-trained, reskilled, upskilled continuously. So very often, you know, what I observe, HR sometimes, you know, there is a feeling that anyone can do HR or anyone can do marketing or whatever. Those are soft professions. You can just come and do that part. I think now what I'm observing with so much changing, you talk about COVID and black swans, but look what else, you know, gig economy, the agility, the skill-based shift in HR, the artificial intelligence coming up, the neuroscience development and the impact it has on leadership. HR profession changes upside down. So if you are not really being highly professional skilled, it's very hard for the HR to be resilient in these times. So I believe in HR number two, to make HR resilient and to make organization resilient, HR organization resilient, you really have to double down on skilling part.
I think the you know, upskilling, reskilling, whatever we want to skilling call it, I mean, the capabilities are so important because, you know, the traditional things of human resources, I think we need to change that. I totally agree with you with people and organizations. But with HR in general, in the classic terms, it served a function when it came to sort of understanding the ins and outs of what it is to employ people or exit interviews and such. It's a completely different beast now. It has evolved, and it's, I think, HR departments such as yours and your team have had to evolve to understand, to take a new perspective of that, whether it's the neuroscience, whether it's looking at well-being, what emotional intelligence is, psychological safety, inclusion, diversion, all of these words. I mean, they can sound like management speak, but when you really look at the nuts and bolts and understand what each of these elements are, they add to resilience because they're not just fluff words. They actually have impact and meaning when you're talking about how people show up, how people deal with uncertainty, how they deal with lack of control when outcomes are not always predictable. And to have that, from again, this is anecdotal from my experience talking to professionals of your caliber, that capabilities and the upskilling and the reskilling of capabilities are so important in these times.
Yes. And it also, if you as a HR professional finding a few minutes to really train yourself, to really allow yourself to be a student, to ask questions, to be curious, and not just to float by, you know, knowing these buzzwords, but to really go deeper into the meaning, you know, it builds your resilience. So you feel safer. You have, you know, more psychological safety yourself, but also it builds the organizational muscle of the company you're working for. Right. So the capability of HR would be my really strong number two.
Yeah. And what would be three on your hit list there, Svetlana?
On my hit list, number three is very much about relationships. You know, if you look into the organizations, Jason, you know, and very often I hear the stories describing organizations as engines. You know, it's an engine that works, and all details have to be connected, and they have to be, like, you know, oiled, and it has to work smoothly, right? I think that image of a company is also changing, because if you look into the company as evolving organism, realize that it's not. I mean, you cannot mechanically fix it. Engine, you can fix mechanically. You can do the rework here and there. You can change some processes. It's going to work out. If you look into the organization as an evolving organism,
yes,
that is very much about the relationships. It's very much about, you know, how you connect unconnected, how you create networks, how you create communication channels, and create forums for people to come together and build connections. I think that would be my number three on the resilience part. And now looking into the years after pandemic, I'm working in the organization that is quickly growing, right? I look into my data and I see that, you know, almost 50% of our people have been hired in the pandemic, meaning they haven't met each other face to face. They haven't connected to each other. They haven't spent some time together. And I think it's going to impact on resilience. I think we really have to come and find those moments that matter, that connects people and allow them to build stronger bonding to each other. Because spending time with each other is a very basic need.
Well, in part one, Svitlana talked about the first three parts of a five-part model that she uses, that she believes is important when building organizational resilience. Now, the first one she talked about was decentralizing process and empowering people in the field. And this is so important because it helps to build a sense of accountability and trust and responsibility. And distributing authority across the fields, well, that allows for a flexibility and adaptability. The second key point that Svitlana made was HR capabilities, where there's a continuous focus on development, on growth, reskilling and upskilling, so we do not grow stagnant. And one of the things the pandemic taught us was that certain skills, such as concentrating on well-being, mental health, psychological safety, social cohesion, emotional intelligence, and many more skills are so important today as leaders and managers and HR professionals. And the third point Svitlana made was to look at organizations as an evolving organisms, and at the heart of that growth of that organism is the ability to build and maintain relationships, to create those connections, and to strengthen those connective tissue between people, departments. In part two of our conversation, Svitlana talks about two other points. One being, well, it's to understand the real-time situational analysis of what's going on in the organization. In other words, it's checking the pulse of the organization, and that's by using the collected data, the data on engagement, the data on tracking attrition and exit interviews, and staying in constant dialogue. The second point she talks about, well, it's about building leadership trust and psychological safety. Well, let's slip into the stream and into part two with Svitlana. You can have several departments within an organization, but unintentional silos come up. And as you're saying, it's an evolving organism where relationships is the connective tissue in that organization in order for it to evolve. You know, what are some of your suggestions, if we get nuts and bolts here, to try to bring down silos between departments? I mean, are there certain things to help create better connective tissue, communication lines and bridges?
One thing is just simple focus and care about that, Jason, right? Mm-hmm. So know that, you know, when we pay attention to something and we call things out, you know, it's like watering the flower. Mm-hmm. So talking about that, educating your leaders that connections matter, helping them to find those connections that actually are logical for the business, I think this is really a part of my work. So being very close to the leadership teams, understanding where it makes sense and logically you can bring people together. So that would be number one element. Another angle could be is creating networks around, you know, different interests that you have in organization. For example, women in tech, when you are supporting women who are trying to be, you know, and on the journey to be upskilled into the technology or who are thriving there already. Connecting them together, sharing the needs that they have, creating those networks and support networks with each other. And that's another example of how you can do that. So different employee representation groups, celebrating different moments that are very human, right?
Like successes or achieving a milestone of something?
successes project-wise, yes, those are business reasons. But if you come to work as a whole human being, as an individual, I would say, you know, celebrating birthdays or celebrating big achievements. So it might be private ones, but being vulnerable, connecting, those things people remember, and they actually stay in there. They create those bonds with each other that would last longer in the teams. So being open-minded about those topics and themes that can bring people together and create bonds and connections, I think it's a muscle which should be trained in organization.
I really like your analogy of comparing it to a muscle, because sometimes when I'm in out of organizations, they will say, okay, we need to have a session. We need to bond. We need to create this relationships and build rapport with each other. But that it's like a rah, rah, rah session. It goes once and then it just kind of dies out, and they just assume that people will continue the journey. But like training a muscle, you need to go to the gym two or three times a week to constantly, you know, tear the muscle so it becomes bigger and heals and such. And so I think from what I hear you saying, Svitlana, there has to be a conscious, cognizant attention on moving that towards actions and having it on top of mind for a lot of people. Is that what I understand?
Yes, absolutely. It is a muscle. It's a richness, a habit. This is what resilience is, Jason, right? So it's not one thing you can do once a month or you can do once a year and you're going to get resilient. This is a continuous focus and continuous training, whether it's your leadership team and it's your people, or if you think about wider organizational scope, that has to be on your agenda day to day.
You said there was five. So what's number four on your hit list there?
The data part. So I believe that data and shared data builds resilience, organization. And again, to remind ourselves, we are talking about not just personal resilience, but organizational resilience and HR. So having the real-time situational analysis of what's happening in your organizations from HR perspective, I think it's a must, right? It's like everybody knows, you know, what data is. Everybody knows that you can drive a car. Yeah. Not everybody has a driving license. So it's like what I'm saying, that I think HR professionals have to get a driving license in the data fields, because I mean, you look in your data enough, even I'm analyzing my data for of my organizations, I sometimes feel, I could have prevented this resignation if I knew it's a month before. Or I could have actually helped the interactions here if I knew that before. And very often companies have that data. They're just not using it. Or there is no habit, or there is no culture of using data. And there is no focus on the data in here. So as in pandemic, you know, data in the COVID times was crucial. We have been checking every single day what is happening. Now in the war of Ukraine, I'm checking every single day what is happening. So that resilience, that focus on the shared data would be my strong number four.
I'd like to come back to talking about the Ukraine in a sec, but I'd like just to finish these five points. But just the data in the information, I think, if I understand it, is that also about feedback loops, feedback about performance, feedback about well-being, feedback about how am I sort of checking in with each other? But is it also about managing expectations, having that constant communication flow? Is that what I understand you're communicating?
So when I talked about data in the HR sphere, all that you said, Jason, very relevant. And actually, this is my number five. This is very much trust and psychological safety and feedback, then that's there for sure. What I mean about data for the HR professionals is just to know the level of engagement of your people across. Because we as a HR profession, we do have the data. Leadership teams have the data. You know, understanding, to give you another example, we all track attrition, right? We all track attrition. We know the exit interviews. We have the data that we collect by people leaving organizations. But it's also how can we be more proactive on that part and maybe conduct stay dialogues and understand my data points, why people stay and where people stay and how I can use it to build up my teams. Is knowing where I have potential issues due to big spans and layers, wide spans and big, layers, and then maybe it's too hierarchical, which we have to really have a look into. So it's a continuous focus on organizational data from the HR profession that can help you be one step ahead and build more resilient response or be more resilient as organization per se.
And so what I was talking about when it comes to feedback and managing expectations, that's more of a segue into your fifth point.
Yes. Number five is the leadership and trust and psychological safety. Mm. So it's the openness, creating that safety for your teams, creating trust, be transparent, and be able, not shy away from the feedback, right? But be able to talk to each other, whether it might be, constructive situations where you have to correct behaviors, or whether, something is slipping in the project, but also celebrating. So those feedback culture and the leadership would be my strong number five.
Feedback is something that we all need to do, and it's everyone can give feedback, but the challenge I find on a lot of teams is this sense of agreeableness sometimes, where people don't want to hurt other people, or they assume that if I give sort of corrective feedback or have a difficult conversation that I'm going to hurt someone or I'm going to feel bad afterwards. And this sense of agreeableness, then sometimes these underlying elements, it could be underlying animosity, it could be addressing the elephants in the room, they're not addressed, and things kind of go on, but there's this toxicity that if it's not addressed, well, things will fall apart. Things will come apart. But how do you encourage people? How do you build up the confidence in people to have these sessions? Yes, celebrating things. I mean, I think that's easier, and I think that's a definitely strong point. But then there's the other side of the coin where it's about addressing and holding people accountable. How do you encourage that? Because sometimes that's what I find it's difficult in organizations when they're trying to create a feedback culture, how to build that individual confidence to approach each other, to create that trust and transparency.
What you're describing, Jason, is this artificial harmony. Mm. Everything is, when we don't give each other feedback, it's all good. We are being silent in meetings. Meetings are boring. We're not, sharing our opinions. We just, sit still and look into the time when it's going to be over. So I think to create that feedback exchange, it's not a one-off. I think trust is crucial for that. So building trust and building psychological safety, saying that, listen, we are human beings, we are vulnerable, creating those bonding and that transparency of relationship with each other as, with the HR community or in leadership rounds with your teams is crucial. And then I found what is helpful to my team, for example, is to encourage good conflicts. Yeah, so I believe in conflicts.
What do you mean? Can you elaborate on that? I'm curious about that.
Sure. So if you have trust and you have psychological safety, I think you should be allowed to express your opinions. Yeah, and then debate with each other. And then the meetings are as interesting as movies, right? Because you can actually express what you truly believe, what you stand behind. And then once you are heard and you feel heard and everybody, was able to express what they think about here, you can make a decision, right? And as a leader, I can make a decision, or my team member who is empowered can make a decision, or we jointly can make a decision, and we disagree and commit, yeah? But it's easy for you to disagree when you are heard. I think it's just important to make sure that people's opinions are heard and our needs are acknowledged. And then with all the cards on the table, then it's easier to have this accountability behind the decisions and go into execution. So I think you should not shy away from these type of conflicts and encourage them, because diversity of opinions, Jason, we know is never easy, right?
That it isn't. But it's so important towards psychological safety to have that, to share opinions, to question why we're going in a certain direction, and to understand underlying reasons behind reasons or behind directions or behind decisions. I was wondering, if we get in a little weeds here, I mean, some managers will sometimes have a super sensitive or oversensitive person, and that when you give them any type of feedback, even though it's well-meant and it's directed, that person takes it, they take it personally and it shuts them down. What advice from your experience would you give to managers and leaders how to deal with people who tend to be on the overly sensitive side?
Again, this is not one-off. I think the advice would be to really be connected. To be connected with your team and to your team members. So negative feedback doesn't have to come. And I don't like to call it negative, but just the feedback doesn't have to come one-sided, right? So there are a number of things which a person is doing wonderfully. We're just not saying that out. So encourage a person more. Try to understand, you know, where the person is really excelling and doing good at, and where do you see there's a potential for improvement. So I think if you really double down on the opportunities, the good sides which you're seeing, it will be much easier for you to have a discussion about areas which have to be improved. And again, if you acknowledge the needs of a different person and you also look into the problem as something or a project as something which is not connected to you personally, like you're on the same side, you're trying the same cause. So how can both of you achieve this cause better, faster, with more quality? What will help? So coaching, asking questions, you know, really trying to make sure that there is an ownership in there and not shying away from those conversations. And it's, again, it's a muscle. You need to start training that. You need to start stop shying away from those conversations. And if you do it, you know, a few times, you might not get it right, but then third time you'll get it right and you will manage to find this connection with the person. So in my experience, it's a journey. You need to start a journey. You need to start connecting to people, getting to know them better, and start from the positive part and understand the needs and separate yourself from the problem.
I think that's very important, what you said. It's the coaching and the questioning, because, you know, feedback doesn't always have to come in the form of me giving you statements, telling you what needs to be improved or what have you, or what I've seen, but it's asking questions. Questions, as you said, based on curiosity, to try to understand the DNA of the person's thinking or the reasoning behind a certain action or behavior or response, and actually getting them through questionings to make the connections themselves. And for me, that's some sound advice you've just shared, because when people come to the conclusions themselves based on good questions that are not sort of based on it's based on development and not evaluation. And if those questions, if people can make those connections in their head, well, that's true wisdom. And they take a sense of ownership and responsibility. And then you can ask them, as I understand, it's like, well, how do you move that forward? How can we implement your ideas? And I think that is also a very good way you've suggested, coaching and questioning, to get to give sometimes oversensitive personalities feedback, but in a different way, where we can ask and we don't always have to tell. Is that what I understand you're coming from, your angle?
Yes, and I'm smiling listening to you, Jason, because, you know, when you start asking questions and connect to a person more, I found myself very often saying, oh my gosh, that's a new angle. I never thought about it, actually. Yes, you can think that way. You can solve the problem this way. And then even, you know, my initial impulse to give feedback to a person resulted into my aha moment and a new angle of looking into the problem.
Because I find when I'm coaching managers, you know, it doesn't matter what age they are. Let's just say they've been promoted to a position where they are responsible for people. A lot of them have to think, I have to come up with the answer. I have to know. And I said, you know, a lot of the times you can just go to the well and draw the water. And what I mean by that is just go to the employee, go to your direct report and ask him what he or she thinks they could do. And I said, you don't always have to come up with the answers. You can help guide them. You can create guide rails. But, you know, sometimes they will have better answers. They'll come up with options that maybe you didn't even think of. And that builds responsibility, that builds confidence and such. I completely concur with you there, Svitlana. In the concluding chapter of our conversation, I shifted the conversation because I wanted to understand how Svitlana defines personal resilience. And she mentioned three crucial factors. And as we delved into each of these factors, it was into the context of the Ukraine war, the invasion, and how that personally affected her, her family, and her friends. And so the first crucial factor she talked about was the ability to have a positive mindset. Now, you can talk to any number of scores and scores and scores of people that know Svitlana, and they will always describe her mindset in glowing terms, that she is positive, she's optimistic, and she's solution-focused. But when the news hit her that the Russians had invaded her homeland of the Ukraine and how that was affecting her friends and family, well, that mindset got shook. But she stumbled, but she picked herself up and found the positive and optimistic way of moving forward and dealing with that situation, how she could help her countrymen the best way she could. The second factor we talked about was the importance of the sense of community and building relations. And this became so apparent when she and her family were hit the news with the invasion, how her neighbors, how her community came out and supported her and her family. The third point she made, which is so important to personal resilience, well, it's the sense of moving forward. Whether it was only a tiny shift or a monumental jump, leap forwards, it's that movement forward. And then what's important is that sense of action, that you can take control, that you can influence the situation. But I'll let Svitlana speak more to this. Well, I hope you enjoyed the concluding part of our conversation. So Svitlana, you've talked about five different points. I was just wondering, just for the sake of the listener, could you just quickly summarize those five points in this model that you use?
It's a pleasure, Jason. So the five elements of resilient organization and HR organization, I would say, is distributed operational model with central coordination. That's how we are organized, number one. Number two, capability and continuously training ourselves, HR profession, number two. Number three, relationships and building connections across organizations. Number four is the data, shared data. And five is leadership and trust and psychological safety.
I think those are five strong pillars. And if you can have those staple pillars, it sounds like you know, if you get the fundamentals right, if you get the groundwork right, then you can build as high as you want in the organization. So thanks for sharing that. I think those are very salient points. I'd like to shift talking about resilience to the people level, to shift from the organization and teams down to the individual people level. I'd like to pick your brain about that. What's your take on that?
What resilience for me is actually, it's very much around the positive attitude, Jason. Mm. You know, I've been very positive, and so far, and hopefully I will be quite a positive person. Yeah, I would find something, you know, good, even if the situation is very dark, right? So you always will try to create a greater story and not be a victim, but, you know, rise above and see the opportunities out there. So the positivity, in my view, is not stupidity. It's actually, so with years, I realized that positivity is actually leadership. An ability and how you, you know, come out stronger, and how you also create positive stories for people around you. So how do you stop the victimizing modes and help people see the other angles? I remember, you know, when the Ukrainian situation hit, so on the 24th of February, and it was already around March, I called you. My positivity wasn't there anymore, and I couldn't see anything positive, you know, happening around, and the world went upside down. For me, my family, and what has been happening in my apartments with the refugees who were fleeing and trying to find a home. And I remember what you mentioned to me, and that helped me a lot, Jason. So it's also around positivity, but a different angle. I think you helped me understand self-compassion, right? And look into maybe not being mindful at this very moment because situation is very dark. Maybe you don't see anything positive right now, but just to look back and realize where you are and how much has been done and how much has been achieved and what you currently have. So when you really reflecting and being a bit more self-compassionate, that helped me to get back my track to positivity. Yeah.
It was a conversation that moved me too, because everything was so raw, everything was so new, and you know, it was an ongoing developing situation, you know. And when we talked on the phone to help you to find that stability, because you had to be the pillar, the stability for all those people coming into your home. You opened your home to the Ukrainians, and being Ukrainian yourself with your friends and family, you know, I've never been in such a situation, so it was very hard for me to relate to what you're going through. But I think it also gave me a sense of objectivity to ask you some of the harder questions, for you to reflect on self-compassion, to find your own stability. Because as you said, I have to be there for my kids. I have to be there for my family and friends. And you've always been there. You've always been that pillar for a lot of people. But sometimes even the pillar needs to be sometimes strengthened. And I think through our conversations, you found that self-compassion, and it wasn't always about where you were going, but it's what you had. So I think you articulated that quite well, and hopefully the conversation has helped you move forward.
You gave me another trick around that, just not to lose that part, is you told me to shift, you know, my watch from my left hand to my right hand. And this is what I did, and that really helped to every time remember that the situation is not normal, right? Mm-hmm. You have to be self-compassionate. You have to keep on going. But yes, it's not normal situation. Let's not have this toxic positivity. Yeah, it's super bad, but you have to continue, and you have to, you have to be resilient, yeah, in a sense. So positivity for me is one element. Another one for people is what also I mentioned for organizations is the relationships and your network that supports you. Because this is what I realized, and it was for me a very personal realization, because I always knew that, but this is kind of the elements when you have this aha moment. I live here in a very small city. It's a city of Bonn. It's in Germany. So we have here kind of an American compound where many families, international German families, live and work in different organizations. They have their own lives. And I was mind blown how everybody stood up and how they have been bringing, you know, food and clothes and, you know, money and, you know, vouchers for supermarkets, and just calling and asking, how are you, from the community, from my work and from my team. The strength that I received by people standing up and by just actually doing something little, it doesn't have to, you know, it doesn't have to be big, but something little, supporting Ukraine by sending money, finding and buying boots for the soldiers in Ukraine, something small that's really built up my resilience a lot. And I realized that we should never, ever underestimate the power of connections and the power of relationships. And the people who are next to you, because you would never know who will stand up. That was an amazing, Jason, experience, and I'm super grateful for every single of these people who stood up for us.
It is very heartwarming to understand that you have these different cultures, and that where the humanity comes out, you know, where the humanity comes out, where there's a sense of community, you know, where before it was just neighbors and people you'd say hi to as you're throwing out the garbage or getting the mail or coming home and such. But all of a sudden, when something so significant lands on your doorstep, and how people step up and show up and how they support each other. You know, one of the major things out of sort of depression or having no sense of purpose is sometimes creating community. It's giving to others. It's that sense of contribution. And that sense of contribution is a huge connective tissue for psychological safety and community. Because when we can reach out and support each other, it brings us in a, I don't know how sometimes how to articulate it, but there's this feeling of community and being in a neighborhood to support each other. And so this was one of the major things. It was the relationships and the connective tissue that really helped give you and the community around you this sort of personal resilience. Is that what I understand?
Absolutely. And it gives a sense of resilience and gives inspiration. It gives hope. Mm. Yeah. We are really behaving as humans to each other. That gives hope to me. So that was super crucial. And another element which really helped to build up my resilience and helps build up my resilience today for myself, for my family, for Ukraine, but also for my teams that I'm leading is the sense of progress. Yeah. So, and it doesn't have to be very big ones, but a feeling that whatever you do it results in a movement, not in emotion, not in firefighting here and there, which is like useful, disorganized, and it just kind of drains you. But a sense of a progress that you are getting closer to the goal, right? So be it again, now looking into Ukraine, today's G19, you know, meeting over there. And I know my president, he had a speech this morning. I woke up, it already was finished. People who are, again, as I mentioned, you know, collecting money to buy winter clothes or, you know, sending out sun batteries to Ukraine for the people not to freeze there. Like small elements that you see that your actions are creating something which results in the movement, in the progress. That is super important. And for me, that's another element which builds my resilience, because I see that it's step by step, you know, millimeter by millimeter, we are moving towards the right goal. And I would say the same for, you know, for the people in my team, in the HR teams, you know.
Yes.
When you work in HR, it's very easy to be in this, you know, mumbo jumbo, firefighting, emotion type of things. Which you don't see what is the progress for your work. You do something, but what is the result of it, right? To give a sense of a progress to your teams and to show how your work is impacting the bottom line, how it's impacting organization, company, culture, to have some data points behind it. That sense of progress motivates and builds resilience of a team to a big extent.
And I think that's very true. I mean, that's a very motivating, engaging point, is that when I can see the results of my efforts, when I can see, you know, how it plays out, how it affects others. And I think that's one point, which is really good. But the previous point you've also made is about moving things to action, taking concrete action. Where can I invest my efforts? And even if it's only a millimeter or a centimeter or a meter, it's a movement forward, it's progress. And so as I understand you're saying, progress is two things. It's where I can take action, where I can create a sense of certainty and have a sense of autonomy. But the second part of that is also sometimes seeing the results of my efforts, the results of my contributions. And so I really like the way you've talked about how progress adds to personal resilience.
Yes, action and then seeing progress. And it doesn't have to be, as I mentioned, it doesn't have to be a big one. It can be a very small one. So that's, for me, is a part of a formula. So a positive attitude, relationships, networks, and a sense of progress would be my top three for personal resilience.
Well, Svetlana, I really appreciate your time, and I really appreciate you sharing your knowledge and your experience, both as a Ukrainian, but as an HR professional who has deep experience and knowledge in this area. As we close out the episode, I would just like to say, I'd just like to kind of tap into your head again. You know, for those young professionals, men and women coming up through the ranks, from your experience, what advice would you give them on finding confidence and stepping into leadership roles or HR roles?
If you have that desire in yourself to step into the leadership roles, do it. That's the simple advice. Do it. Get your lesson learned. Create your networks. Get your hands dirty. I think this is the only way to really find if this is for you or not by just doing it. So my advice would be, do not overthink. The experience comes with practice. It comes with years. And now we have so much available for people. You know, your podcast, Jason, helps build resilience for people. We didn't have it before. So for the younger professionals, you know, there's abundance of really information and support and networks for people who want to stand up and be there for them. They just have to reach out. So the key advice would be from my side, just do it.
Yeah. And it's to embrace the experience. And I think it's having that learning mindset. Go on, as you said, get your hands dirty. I think that's, I really like that. You know, get your hands dirty, embrace the experience and learn. You can have a bad day, but it doesn't mean a bad job or a bad position or a bad life. You know, we all have rough days and rough weeks, but it's how we learn and the lessons we can take from that to add to, as you said, a positive narrative, a positive mindset. So Svitlana, thank you very much for your time. I hope we have another conversation soon to see how things are developing with you and your organization and the world of HR.
Thank you, Jason. It's been really a pleasure, and thank you for doing what you do. I think this is a very important mission to help people build resilience, and I hope it was useful to listen to my experience here. And I want to say to all my Ukrainian folks and people who are listening to your podcast that glory to Ukraine, and Ukraine will prevail.
Thank you, Svitlana.
Thank you, Jason.
Well, folks, that was the fabulous Svitlana Belushkina. Well, Svitlana, thank you very much from the bottom of my heart for taking the time from your busy, busy job at Zalando and for being so open and generous with sharing your thoughts and your stories about building individual organizational resilience, as well as your personal story as a Ukrainian and your personal experience and reflections on that unnecessary war. Well, dear listeners, that brings us to a tail end of another great episode. My call to action to you, if you could please rate, share, and subscribe to the podcast, that would be great. And if you know, to colleagues, to friends, to family members that you think the content of this podcast would help or could benefit from, please share it with them. You'd be doing me a huge solid on that, spreading the word. And if you'd like to subscribe to the podcast newsletter, I launch it every Wednesday morning. It includes the latest episode, sometimes an article, sometimes a blast from a past, which is a past episode that I wanted to bring back up to your mental radar. You can find all the notes on Svitlana and the links and what have you in the show notes. Well, anyways, folks, thanks for showing up again. And until next week, keep well, keep strong, and we'll speak soon.